Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Michael Cunningham, whose latest novel is By Nightfall. Earlier novels, A Home at the End of the World, Flesh and Blood, The Hours, Specimen Days. Also the editor of a book of poetry called Laws for Creations. This particular book is a character study of an individual, a guy who's a contemporary art dealer and his family. And I understand from a discussion you had that I saw on YouTube with James Franco that what got you going was the fact that you started out in the art world as an artist. Is that correct?
I started out trying to be a painter. I never actually got as far as being in the art world because by the time I was in college, I was beginning to understand that I just wasn't really a painter. I didn't have a sufficient gift. So I started writing, and I wasn't sure if I had a sufficient gift for that either. But I found that when I started writing, I had this sort of bottomless interest in the proposition of trying to produce life using only ink and paper, and I've never lost that interest.
The interrelationship of all different art forms, on the one hand, this craft, but when it comes to art, there's a certain similarity. I mean, you always have to be who you are and unique to yourself in any art form.
Sure, sure, absolutely. You have to have not only a vision, but a certain body of, shall we say, idiosyncrasies, whether it is a particular way of turning a phrase or a particular way of producing a line on paper.
I think an actor has to get that deep, too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I know enough actors, James among them, to know that the method is not unlike what I go through in trying to inhabit a character. You sort of take what you know from your own life and you project it into another body until you begin to actually inhabit a body different from your own.
Well, when you were starting the book Before Nightfall, did you know that this book, this entire book, would be so centric to one character, Peter Harris?
No. I never know what I'm doing when I set out to write a novel. I'm not especially well organized or far-sighted, and I just try to let the book start to write itself, and this turned out to be very much centered on this one guy. It's been quite a while since I've written a book with a single identifiable main character.
And a single identifiable, not merely point of view, but voice of the character, because he's a very unique voice as well.
Yeah. You just kind of noodle around until you find not just the character and the voice, but the book itself. I feel like one's first instinct should always be to tell the story as simply and directly as possible. And only if that doesn't prove sufficient, which was the case in a novel like The Hours, do you try it some other way. But this book is probably my most straightforward, singular, relatively outwardly simple novel. You never know what you're going to come up with next.
Does that mean that the way The Hours assembled itself went through different permutations, more permutations, say, than this one?
Yeah, absolutely. It started out simply to be a modern-day version of Wolfe's Mrs. Dalloway. And that just felt like a sort of empty conceit after a while. Who needs another version of Mrs. Dalloway? We've got the actual Mrs. Dalloway. And so I just started playing around with it, and I thought of maybe I should put Virginia Woolf herself in this somehow, and that still didn't feel quite sufficient. And then I thought, well, maybe I should put someone a little bit like my mother in it. And then it became this triptych, but it grew out of a fairly simple, singular idea.
Then after that came Specimen Days, which focuses on Whitman. Wolfe starts The Hours. What starts this book? What starts By Nightfall?
Well, By Nightfall is, though I hope this isn't too obvious, a sort of homage to Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, one of my favorite books. People can't tell, but I have it tattooed all over my body. You can see it. I have the entire text of Death in Venice tattooed on my face and body. It is one of my very favorite books, and I have always loved the sort of central notion of Death in Venice, which is, of course, the fixation that an older man develops on a younger man. And while the fixation is eroticized, it's not just about an old lech panting after a young boy. It's about a man who sees beauty incarnate in a young boy.
Peter's only in his early 40s, which means that the age difference between his brother-in-law, Mizzy, Ethan, and him is under 20 years. I mean, the context is different.
Yeah. I didn't want to rewrite Death in Venice. I was very much influenced by the idea of a fixation, a kind of obsession on a younger man who feels like a god, who feels like some visitation of the supernal.
Then if you're talking about an idealization of the form of the human beauty, did you go from there to the art world, or did you start with the art world and the idea of beauty and then go to Ethan?
I started with the characters and then went to the art world. I thought, well, here's Peter, a man in his 40s, looking for beauty in the world, looking for something to adore, and what better profession for him than the buying and selling of art?
And at that point, did you start doing your research?
Yeah. I knew a fair amount about the art world anyway. A lot of my friends are artists. A couple of my friends are art dealers. And the heroic and heroically patient Jack Shainman of the Jack Shainman Gallery in New York let me hang out and sort of learn firsthand how it is to run a gallery.
The gallery itself is dealing with certain kinds of artists. There's one artist who wraps his paintings in a way that nobody can see what's underneath, and of course what they can't see is always going to be better than what is.
Well, that's the point. That's exactly the point. He is asserting that we are looking for a greater painting than anyone could possibly produce, so he shrouds these paintings in paper and linen and waxes them and ties them up so that you are looking at not a painting, but your ideal image of what a painting might be.
But that's theoretical art. Tom Wolfe's old essay, The Painted Word, kept coming back to me.
Yeah. His fabulously curmudgeonly essay on what he considered to be the disreputable state of contemporary art. I'm not quite as tough on contemporary art as Tom was. I think some of it is actually valid and interesting. But like Peter, like my character in the novel, I do feel that there is a certain kind of earnestness and a kind of adoration in older art that I sometimes miss in a construction made of tin foil string and tin cans.
But the point of the essay itself was that in order to understand or appreciate the art, you needed to understand and read the theory.
Yeah. Art is produced in a context. Art involves a certain knowledge of the thinking of the artist and the culture in which the artist lives. But hey, don't you need to know something about 19th century Russia in order to really appreciate Anna Karenina?
But the difference, I would say, is that if I see, let's say, these headphones on the floor in a gallery or at someone's house with a little sign saying headphones, obviously if I read the book about the headphones, I'll get some kind of idea of what the artist is trying to do. But on the other hand, I'm not going to just sit there and go, oh, look, art.
Yeah. Well, this is what is either compelling or nauseating or both about much art of the last half century, starting with Duchamp's urinal. What is art? That is the question that artists are asking, and I don't think it's a ridiculous question. I find it problematic sometimes. Do we just want more still lifes and landscapes forever? I think what's going on in visual art, which is very different from what writers do, is the whole questioning of whether art is something sort of sacred and separate and kept in a frame on the wall, or is it something that's all over the place? Isn't there something strangely beautiful about that Duchamp urinal? And if someone is saying, look at these headphones on the floor, aren't they saying the headphones have a kind of aesthetic and a kind of beauty in themselves? I don't think it's just a hoax on the public. I think it's part of a genuine questioning on the part of artists. And we as consumers are always free to say, I don't want that.
And that comes back in terms of, you know, these beautiful sculptures with porn on them that get delivered in your book.
Right.
The woman living in Greenwich is interested, but she's also kind of enjoying the fact that when her guests come and see these beautiful sculptures and actually read the obscenities, that they're going to be flipped out.
Well, sure. She wants to be cutting edge, but not too cutting edge. She wants to be just shocking enough for her own purposes. What's most problematic to me about art is the whole question of art and money. I have a friend who put on a show recently in which she produced a number of abstract paintings that are as similar as they can possibly be, but she arranged them in two rows. The bottom row was priced at $3,000, and the ones on the top row were priced at $300,000. And sometimes she would switch the rows. And still, it was a little bit difficult. Even if you were in on the joke, it was a little bit difficult not to look at the ones on the top row, the $300,000 paintings, as somehow containing something that the other ones lacked. I don't think the trouble so much is that artists are putting headphones in the corner and saying this is art. I think the problem is that people are putting headphones in the corner and saying this is art, and it costs $1 million. What I think we're balking at is not the sort of open up the world to aesthetics business, as it is the idea that, and this is something that comes from certain art dealers, that it has to be a precious object. It has to be simultaneously ordinary, and then it has to cost a hell of a lot of money.
Michael Cunningham, let's get back to the character, because this is a character study and also a study in the art of writing. I mean, every sentence is specifically constructed. You said in your discussion with James Franco that you can sometimes write a sentence 50 times until you get it right.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, I'm a little autistic that way.
Or OCD.
Oh, I am quite OCD.
In terms of the character of Peter Harris, there's mention early on of a brother, Matthew, who died of AIDS. When that mention came in, were you going to create the doppelganger effect between Matthew and Mizzy, or did that just emerge organically?
It emerged organically, but then I realized that unconsciously, as I thought to write that chapter about Peter's lost brother, it was, of course, a kind of mirroring of his obsession with this reincarnated brother. But I don't write especially intelligently. I write very much from the seat of my pants, and then I bring whatever intelligence I have to bear on the big mess of a first draft that I've got and see what the patterns seem to be, see what I dreamed up that I didn't understand, and I discard most of it.
In the old days, you would just start putting a new piece of paper in the typewriter. These days, how does that process work? Do you just go back to the original file and just begin anew, or do you print it out and then work off the printing, or what?
I still need a printed page in my hand, but I love the computer. I think the computer is the writer's best friend. There's something about the whole idea of a sentence that is on the screen, so it is on one hand more tangible than it was when it was in your head, but it's also these little liquid letters made of light. It isn't ink on paper yet. It's like a sort of hallucination you're having, and it feels much more malleable. It makes the language feel more malleable and more liquid than it ever did when I was hammering letters into paper in a typewriter.
Matthew died of AIDS, and what we're dealing with here is a brother years later recalling that, and it sometimes feels as if that entire era is almost like the 1918 flu. It's receding into the background, and yet the effects of it from siblings, parents still, and the art world in particular is still astonishing.
Yeah. It's a little bit like having survived a war, and you may have left the war. The war may be over for you, but it hasn't left you. It probably never will.
The idealization, of course, of Matthew, was that the poet Rupert Brooke, the idealization from World War One of the poet who died beautiful.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
I kept reflecting back on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's nothing like an early demise to ensure your immortality. Die young, stay pretty, as Blondie so aptly put it.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Cunningham, whose latest novel is By Nightfall. Peter's wife, Rebecca, how did you ensure that she remained a key element of the book without kind of falling by the wayside in terms of Peter's obsessions?
I just tried to keep track of her. I just tried to keep her sufficiently in the loop. It's a juggling act, all these characters and a kind of single story that they all have to figure in. And I was just always aware that Rebecca had to have her story told, too. I feel like any character in any novel is a novel in and of him or herself, not just Rebecca, but the cab drivers and the waitresses. And you have to keep them moving. You have to keep multiple parallel worlds going on all at the same time. It's part of the trick.
What happens to long-term relationships, how people interrelate? Have you been in a long-term relationship?
I have. I've been with the same guy for 24 years. When I write of long-term relationships, I know from which I speak.
So what element of autobiography do you think sits within the Rebecca-Peter relationship?
Oh, it's not Kenny and me. It's very different. But Eudora Welty once said that you don't need to have experienced the world you write about. You can write a novel set in a logging camp, even if you've never been to a logging camp, but you probably can't write about an emotion you haven't felt. If I'm going to write about a moment of irritation and exasperation in an essentially solid enough marriage, have I felt a moment of exasperation and irritation
sure.
with Kenny? Of course I have. He's never felt that with me because I'm never exasperating or irritating, but I felt it with him.
Which actually comes back to Peter not quite getting the fact when Rebecca says to him, okay, this relationship is falling apart.
Yeah.
Even though from his perspective it is, it never dawns on him that she might have the same feeling.
That she might have the same feeling. Surprise, buddy. Yeah. Yeah.
They're together because they're familiar with one another and they want to be familiar with one another.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They have an abiding affection for each other, but they're comfortable, which is not the worst thing in the world, but one really wants more than comfort.
I think it was on Amazon. I was looking at some of the things that people said, and one kid said that you captured his generation in terms of Mizzy better than most anybody, that kind of flailing around as if
really?
The idea that, oh, I want to be in the arts, but I have no idea what I want to do.
I'm very glad to hear that. I do know a few people Mizzy's age, and every generation has its own world to deal with, and it does seem that young people now are dealing with an especially difficult world. When I was Missy's age, I was a hippie. I was a hippie manque. I wasn't a very good hippie. but I felt like I could just hitchhike around and live fecklessly and recklessly, and if worse came to worse, I could always just get a job in an ad agency and start making $40,000 a year. And that is not in any sane person's mind now at the age of 22.
One major difference I noticed between now and even 10 years ago is that 10 years ago people went to college to learn, and now they go to college only to get a degree.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that?
I have. What could be more terrifying than the idea that there might not be a job out there for you? No matter how well prepared you are, no matter how much you want it, there might simply be nothing for you. That's a terrible thing to have to live with. And I don't blame kids for going to get a degree in order to get a job.
When you were done with that first draft, what did it look like?
It was a mess. It was an unholy mess. No one will ever see any of my early drafts. If I have anything to say about it, if I should die here in the radio station, promise me you will see to it that my papers are destroyed. Because, as I said, I work intuitively and a little sloppily. When in doubt, I put it in rather than leave it out. And I look over what I've got when I finished that first draft and try to corral it into some kind of shape, because believe me, it's just a disaster. It's just all over the place in the first draft.
In terms of the individual words or just the story or what?
More the story. I write pretty carefully as I go along, but I don't know what story I'm telling. I don't know what I'm doing. And that comes later when I just sort of see this mass of free association. I begin to see, oh, there's this and this and this. There are these patterns. This seems to be the story that wants to be told. And then the second draft starts to resemble the book that I will actually write.
Well, in that first draft then, what was in there that just made no sense in the context? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, there were flash forwards to the future for all of these characters. There were whole chapters that followed the trajectories of minor characters, because after all, no one is unimportant. The ending was completely different, and I'm blanking out on what lame-ass ending I had tacked on there, but it wasn't any good.
Normally, in a lot of novels, we see characters come, and then they make the return appearance. It's like you planted the gun in the handbag. You specifically do not do that in this book.
No, I do not. I wanted this book to, in some way, obey some of the laws of randomness that seem to govern our lives. And, in fact, you'll never see that waitress again. You'll never see that cab driver again. You'll never see your best friend from high school again. And I sometimes feel like in searching for pattern, novelists may go a little too far and impose more pattern on the world than the world is actually ready, willing, or able to offer.
Michael Cunningham, by Nightfall, subtext, and I don't know how conscious this was in the writing of the book, concerns the nature of orientation identification.
Hmm.
Is someone gay or straight?
Right.
Do you think there's too much emphasis on orientation now?
I think some of us tend to put too much stock in the simple categories of gay, straight, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered. I'm not sure if those are especially meaningful in terms of the information they convey. How much does a leather daddy actually resemble his gay brother who is monogamous and lives in the suburbs with his husband and their children? Does the fact that they're gay really imply that they have much in common in terms of their sexual orientation? Is the fact that they both do it with men the be-all and end-all? I don't really think so.
The similarity that I can see, and it's a similarity that you and I have,
mm-hmm.
is that we had to deal with certain issues growing up, and we had to come out.
Yeah, there's always that. There's always that. What's the difference between being black and being gay? You don't have to tell your parents you're black. And we do have that in common. And it's why every openly gay person is at least a little bit heroic to me, because I know that every openly gay person has had to go to real trouble to assert her or his identity. And you get extra points with me for that.
The other part of it is something Alan Gerganis once said in an interview. He said, it's interesting about being gay because you always have to come out whenever you meet someone new.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah, I have found that I'm pretty casual about it. I meet a lot of new people. It's pretty widely known that I'm gay, but I find that I don't make much of a point of it one way or the other. And if I am talking to somebody who doesn't know, and I just refer to my boyfriend midway through the conversation, they're usually pretty okay with it. I'm not talking to people who live on the outskirts of Birmingham, Alabama, but I sometimes think that if we gay guys and gals don't treat it as some kind of secret, people don't pick up on it as some kind of secret.
Michael Cunningham, you managed from the beginning to write novels that feature gay characters and never be seen as a, quote, gay novelist.
Which is very much what I wanted, though of course one doesn't have too much control over that. I don't quite know how I escaped the niche, because I feel personally like, yes, I'm a gay writer and a white writer and an American writer and a male writer, and all those things matter. All those things affect the way you experience the world, but they're not singular. They're not monolithic. If I say I don't want my books confined to the gay section, nor would I want my books confined to the white male section.
You escaped something that, to some degree, Edmund White, who's a great writer, did mm-hmm. not escape.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I wonder if it was really just an accident of history and time that Ed kind of pushed things to a certain degree, and then I came along and benefited from some of the territory that Ed had staked out.
Today, of course, there are issues involving gay politics that keep popping up. Lately, there's been that run of suicides and bullying, and at the same time, we've got discussions about don't ask, don't tell as well. What direction do you think we're moving in here?
Oh, just smack me for saying this, but I dearly and desperately hope that we are moving slowly and tentatively forward in our insistence on full and equal rights. I see it in some of my students. They're either openly undisturbedly gay, or they have friends who are gay, and if you suggest that that is in any way unusual, they look at you like you're crazy. At the same time, who could possibly be sanguine about gay rights when kids are jumping off of bridges? How could you possibly imagine that we're moving forward? It's a bit of a conundrum, and I guess it's my hope, with every due respect to those poor kids, that this is some terrible last-minute backlash, that we're farther along. There's a lot of rhetoric out there. There's a lot of hate out there. And at the same time, the gay boy who jumped off the George Washington Bridge is on the cover of People magazine. which would not have happened, I think, 10 years ago. I suspect that gay kids have been killing themselves at an appallingly steady rate for a long time, and finally we're hearing about it.
Are you married?
We are not. I, of course, fully support the right of any LGBT person to get married, but Candy and I don't want to get married. If we were straight, I don't think we'd want to get married. We're just not interested in it. We don't like ceremonies. We know exactly who and what we are to each other, and no, we are two single men who've lived together for 24 years.
Michael Cunningham, I want to ask you about some Hollywood experiences here. You co-wrote the screenplay and was executive producer of a film called Evening?
Yes. They asked me to do it, purely and simply. A very cool production company called Heart Sharp, which no longer exists, asked if I would like to adapt Susan Minot's lovely novel for the screen, and I said yes. Thank you for asking.
And how was it working on that as opposed to The Hours?
It was rough. I would not, again, anytime soon, agree to adapt a novel. It was hard not to feel like I was sort of betraying Susan's work in trying to make it fit on the screen. It felt queasy and uncomfortable, and frankly, anything I might do in the future would be more like an original screenplay.
In terms of writing dialogue, and this goes back to By Nightfall, because you allow Peter to form the most perfect sentences in his head, and yet when you're dealing with character, you could even get away with it when they're speaking in a novel, but you can't get away with it in a screenplay because people have to be speaking it.
People have to be speaking it, and it has to sound naturalistic. It has to sound real. And, of course, we do not speak in iambic pentameter. We do not speak in perfect sentences. We fumble and mumble and go, and And, yeah, you want to try to reproduce that in a screenplay. I do anyway.
Then aren't you losing a little bit of the art by doing that?
I don't think there is anything that isn't artful about perfectly reproducing human speech. What you have to do in a screenplay is get the meaning through the semi-articulation, which is interesting.
I noticed on IMDb they mentioned two other projects. One is a Dusty Springfield project?
Dusty Springfield story with Nicole Kidman. Yes, yes. That is not in the works yet, but it's something I'm doing with Nicole.
You're writing the screenplay?
Yeah. I've sent her the script, and I'm waiting to hear what she thinks of it.
And what is Beautiful Girls?
It's a screenplay that I sold to Screen Gems, and why be coy about it? That's been a disaster. They're bringing in another writer. That has not worked out as I had hoped it would.
Let's go back to Laws for Creations.
Oh, the Whitman collection. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found that I was touring for Specimen Days, a book in which Walt Whitman features prominently, that a lot of people at the readings during the Q&A asked me what Whitman they should read. This is a complicated question when applied to Walt Whitman because, of course, Leaves of Grass exists in 9 different versions, each of them enormous, none of them definitive. The first draft contains some fabulous things that he cut out in the last draft, and the last draft is poor for the loss of that, but then he added blah, 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 blah. I wanted to give people, I just have to say, a Whitman sampler. Just a little taste of some of my own favorite sections of Leaves of Grass so that readers who probably are not familiar with Whitman could just get a sense of why those of us who love him as much as we do. And, of course, it's my wildest hope that people who pick up and like that short collection will actually tackle the whole thing.
And what are you working on now?
I'm working on a new novel.
Already?
Yeah. Oh, I have found the only defense when you have published a novel is to immediately start a new novel so that whatever happens to the existing novel, good, bad, or indifferent, you're shielded because you're working on something new. Oh, that old thing? No, that I barely remember that. I'm into this new one now. It's going to be a lot better.
Do you ever read reviews?
I do not read reviews, good ones or the bad ones. I have no idea. Well, that's not true. That's not true. I have a friend who vets them for me, just so that if a journalist or somebody says, so you really got nailed by the New York Times, I'm not hearing it for the first time. So I have a sense of how they're running, but I never read them.
When you're finished with a book like By Nightfall, do you think back on it much, or do you just kind of put it aside and go, well, it's out there, it's my child?
I try to let it go and think about the new one.
Do you have any theme or topic on the new one that you can talk about, or not yet?
Not yet.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Cunningham, whose latest novel is By Nightfall. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.